of the first part of today's lecture is the study of temporal fluctuations. Of an observable A of t. So we want to prove this thing, that these fluctuations, let me put a t here so we remember it's the temporal ones, so this object is upper bounded by the norm of A, and then something about the initial state. So we will have an initial state phi, and then we have phi bar, which is the time averaged over infinite time, and I remind you that this turns out to be the completely defaced state in the basis of the Hamiltonian. So these guys are En, En. And what we have here is the trace of phi bar square. Okay? So phi bar only contains the populations of the initial state in the basis of the Hamiltonian. And we are saying the purity of this distribution enters, because the trace of these squares is the purity, is what enters in this bound. Okay? So this could be a very small number if your initial state is very spread out in the basis of the Hamiltonian in a large enough Hilbert space. And therefore, if this is not too large, then overall this could be a very small number, which means that the time fluctuations are very small, which represents that plot that I made up, that's something like this. Okay? So almost always you have a typical value. Typical value then being, so this value would be the trace of A exactly in phi bar. Okay, so this is what we want to show. Okay, so to this end, let me define this object phi tilde. So I will have a list of things that I'm going to use, which is phi t minus phi, which is the sum of I think it's minus phi bar. Okay. This object. So basically, from the time evolved state, I'm just subtracting its diagonal part, that is the one that is not evolving in time. So I have m different from n here. Okay, so this is a definition. This is a definition. And notice that this object has no diagonal matrix elements, right? You see, it's only the off-diagonal part in this basis. So this means that its trace is zero. Okay, so let's keep this in mind. Also, let me define H plus the support of phi. So this means that if phi has some zeros in the populations, H bar is that subspace of the Hilbert space where there are no zeros. Okay? And let also P plus be the projector onto this space, H plus. Then let me define the operator norm of A. Let me call it delta A, is the operator of norm of A on H plus. So, you know, A could have a very large norm, meaning that it could happen that it has some very large eigenvalue on some vector in H, but these vectors would not matter when you compute this expectation value, say A of t, if that vector is not supported by your evolution, because if phi does not have a component there, you know, it will not have it. So this is by definition the max eigenvalue of A with psi in H plus and minus the minimum eigenvalue of A in this Hilbert space. So this is the operator norm on H plus. And this defines also these two numbers, A max minus A min. Okay. Finally, last definition that I need, let me define A tilde as A minus this number, A min. And then you can see that the expectation value for A in H plus of H tilde is between zero and delta A. Okay. Okay, so with these definitions, let's start computing our variance, our temporal variance. So we have delta A square t. Let me rewrite here the definition. A of t minus A bar square, A bar. And so what does this mean? This is the time average of the trace, right? These are the expectation values here. Of, so all this is squared, the trace of A in phi t minus A in phi bar. And then A is linear. And, but this is phi tilde t. Okay, so this is equal to the temporal average of the square of trace A phi tilde t. Okay, now remember that phi tilde t is traceless. Okay? So if it is traceless, I can add the trace of a number times phi tilde t, because it's zero anyway. And if I add a minus a minus a min phi tilde t, then this becomes a tilde. Okay. So all I'm saying is that the difference between A phi tilde t and A tilde phi tilde t in the trace is something that is zero. So I can do that. Okay. Okay, so now let me write this in a basis. So what I have to do is to write the time evolution of phi tilde t, which is that thing, and take the trace with A tilde of it, okay, and average on time. And I have to do it twice because it's a square. Okay, so let me do that. So I have a sum over m different than n, and then I have to do it again because I make the product. So I will use order two indices, j and k. And then I have the matrix elements of A tilde, jk, and the matrix elements of phi, kj. And then the same for mn, nm, phi, mn. And then I have the exponential part, that is the part that I'm time averaging, because it's the only one that depends on time. So I have a time average of I, ej minus ek plus em minus en t. Okay. So this is just the straightforward application of that formula squared, and then I take the bar. Okay, so now notice that this sum is, we already have that m is different from n and j is different from k. Okay? So this is different from zero and this is different from zero because we are using a non-degenerate Hamiltonian. Okay, so non-degenerate Hamiltonian. And we see that in the case that this number, which is different from zero, is different from this number, en minus em. So if this is true, then this average is zero, right? Because we would have something here that is fast oscillating and averaged over infinite time is zero, even if it's not fast oscillating. Any oscillating term, bounded oscillating term, average on infinite time is zero. It's the usual trick. So this means that we require, in order in this sum, only survive those terms such that this gap is equal to this gap. Okay? And now we make another assumption that not only we have a non-degenerate Hamiltonian, but we also have a non-degenerate gaps, which means the only possibility that these two gaps are the same is if they are the same pair of levels, that j is equal to n and k is equal to m. So it is equal to zero if and only if j is equal to n and k is equal to m. Is this clear? By the same type of argument that we said degeneracy requires some sort of symmetry, so it's a fine-tuned property, the same is about the degeneracy of the gaps. So this is also not a very strong assumption. Okay, so this becomes, under the assumption of non-degenerate gaps, the sum over only n and m that are different of A tilde nm phi mn A tilde mn phi nm. So you see that this is the modulus square of these two quantities. And I can upper bound definitely if I add in the sum also the diagonal terms, because they're positive, the moduli square. So I can just write very simply the sum over all the n and m's, but I'm making a bound. And then I have a tilde n m modulo square and phi tilde n m modulo square. And this is furtherly upper bounded by this thing. Okay, I keep this like this. Now I can apply the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality to this. So remember that this matrix element is equal to the product of a row by a column. So it's upper bounded by the row and the column. So it's upper bounded by phi nn and phi mn. So I can write this. Okay, so now that I've done this, I can open up again this thing. This becomes the sum over n and m. And this was a tilde. This was a tilde, and this was always phi bar. Oh, no. It is not phi bar, it's phi. However, the diagonal part of phi is phi bar, right? Because phi bar is exactly that. It's the diagonal part of phi. So I can put the bars here. Okay, now that I've done that, let me open up this thing again. This is nothing else but EM A tilde phi bar EN, right? This is diagonal, so the A, one of the A and M is just this. And the other one would be EN, because it's this other guy here, A tilde, phi bar, EM. And the whole reason why actually I added also the diagonal part is the trick that we already used a number of times when we're doing these things, that here I want to have the resolution of the identity. So this is one, when you sum over n. And so we are left with the sum over m of em a tilde square phi bar square EM, which is the trace of A tilde phi bar square. And we said, oh, this is, because we have a bound, this is larger than our fluctuations. So as you can see, we are almost done, right? Because we want to show that this fluctuations are smaller than the norm of A times just the trace of phi bar square. Okay, so exercise, so this is simple. And you find it worked out in the notes, but try to do it by yourself. It's just instructive. But you can expect that, in fact, I can upper bound this expectation value by using the maximum eigenvalue. This is a square. The maximum eigenvalue of a tilde. Right? So it's not too surprising that this should be just delta A square trace of phi tilde square, which is what we wanted. And I think, again, today I made this mistake. Where that is the norm, operator norm of A on H plus. The total operator norm of A is also larger than the one on H plus, so it is just a slightly looser bound. Okay, so now that we have proven this theorem, let's see what it means. Let's do some remarks. So first of all, remember the Chebyshev inequality that says that every time you have a random variable that does have a variance, the probability that the difference from the average is greater than k sigma is smaller than 1 over k squared for every k greater than 0. And now you see that you can choose k equal 1 over the standard deviation. So if the variance is very small, the standard deviation is very small, and k is a very large number. Okay? But now this becomes that the probability of being away more than one standard deviation is smaller than sigma, than the variance, which is an even smaller number. Okay? So you can have both this number and this number small at the same time. So you have a very small probability of being away from a very small quantity from the average. So this is what we call typicality. This means that the value of AT is almost always equal to the value of A bar. The probability of finding AT different from A bar more than square root of sigma is smaller than sigma. And how small can sigma be? Well, is this number. Now imagine the tower operator as a norm that is order 1. Okay? So this is a number of order 1. This is the trace of phi bar square, which is the trace of phi bar square is the trace of the completely defaced state, phi bar, right? So the state in which I only take the diagonal part of the initial state square. So it's the purity of the completely defaced state. So imagine that I am very spread in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, then this is a number that is like 1 over n, where n is the dimension of H. So it's exponentially large in the number of bodies that you have. So this is a number that can be very, very small. You could play let me show you something else. One very good way to visualize all of this is to look at this quantity, LT, that is the modulus squared, I guess, yes, of my initial state with my state at the time t. So what is this? This is the probability that the state at the time t is equal to the initial state, or the overlap of the state of the time at the time t with the initial state. So every time the my initial state starts resembling a little bit more from the average, my initial state, you will see in this quantity one of those little spikes that are called revivals. You can expect that this is sort of is related to the probability of also your observables to have a revival. If you compute the time average of the Loschmidt echo, this is called the Loschmidt echo, this becomes this person. So one thing that you could do is to plot the Loschmidt echo. So you have a Hamiltonian, depends on time, you know the time evolution, you plot this, you take the time average, and you would find this. You can play with the Hamiltonians that you know, because in our XY model, or in an extended model called the cluster XY model, or which you find exact diagonalization by the same tools, but it has only a richer phase diagram than the XY model. So you find the exact eigenstate, so you can write the state that evolves in time. All the procedure is in the lecture notes. By the way, the cluster XY model was solved by one of you for the his Psi essay. Sebastian Montes was a Psi student, and he published this paper on the phase diagram, diagonalization, Loschmidt echo, and the metric, all these things of the cluster XY model. And you can try to see these plots, these things, how they go. You will see graphs like that, etc. Okay. Well, do we have a last remark on this? No. I think. Oh, if I had, it was here. No. Okay. Okay, so now we have seen how is it possible that a quantum system that is evolving unitarily, so the wave function is not equilibrating because it cannot. However, the expectation values of observables can equilibrate in probability in the sense that we have sketched. Oh, yeah, now I remember. If you consider this, so something that I want you to do as an exercise, how does it mean that every observable, if I start with the initial state that is very squat, then behaves like that? Well, not really, because we also have this thing. This thing could be large. And an example is given by this. So consider this observable. A is equal phi to the minus 1 nm en em. So what is it I'm doing? I have my initial state. Let's say that I know perfectly what is my initial state because I've prepared it. And then I decide to plus Hermitian conjugate of this. I decide to measure this thing, okay? In which I have these numbers here. Now notice that if it is very spread, these numbers could be very small. So to the minus 1 could be very large. So try to actually, you see, this thing has a very simple expression in the basis of the Hamiltonian. So you can compute its time evolution of the expectation values. It's a simple exercise. Do it and show that A of t goes like cosine of some frequency t. So you will see that this is, you know, really something that is not equilibrating at all. It's a cosine, it's not damping. So this is an extreme case of how things can go wrong in the case that your norm is very large. Okay. So we can have typicality of expectation values. But now we want to move on to something stronger than just equilibration. We want to talk about the thermalization. So not only we require that at some point our expectation values are steady, they don't change in time anymore, or the fluctuations are so small that you cannot see them, but also that this typical value is like that of a thermal ensemble. Okay? And so let's see how this is possible and why it is actually weird that this should happen. Okay, so consider a generic initial state . So this is a generic initial state. I'm not asking that it's pure right now. So then this thing evolves unitarily in this way. And I don't know if you've done it in the tutorial, but if I compute any Rényi entropy at any time of this thing, what do you expect to find? Have you done it in the tutorial? No. Okay. Anyway, this is easy enough. So remember, what is that I have to do to compute the Rényi entropy of a state? It's a function of what? What is the only thing I need to know of this state in order to compute the Rényi entropy?
The reduced density matrix?
No, but the reduced density matrix is something about entanglement. Okay? Now I have a state, and I want to know the entropy of this state. Okay? So let's start with let's say it's the initial state. What is the entropy of this state? It's the entropy of what? Entropy is a property of a probability distribution, right? Of what probability distribution? Given the state.
PI.
The PI. Okay? For instance, if I have a pure state, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, what is the entropy of this extreme probability distribution? It's zero, right? So it's a property of these things. Now, from the point of view of linear algebra, this probability distribution, what is it with respect to phi? Phi is an operator. The eigenvalues, okay? Now I evolve this unitarily, and I'm asking, now, what is the entropy of this state? I didn't hear?
Same.
The same, right? Because a unitary operation is a change of basis. You cannot change the eigenvalues. Quantum mechanics is linear algebra. So the PIs are the same, and therefore the entropy is constant. So no matter which entropy, any entropic quantity, any function of the spectrum of your state will be constant. So now white thermalization is awkward because imagine, for instance, that I start from a state that is pure. Then phi of t is pure. However, thermalization requires, so this is unitary evolution, but thermalization requires that this goes into the Gibbs state. And is this state pure or not? It's very not pure. If I compute the von Neumann entropy, S1, or the Shannon entropy of this quantity, I have a minus and this is not an extremal. This PI is given by the Bolzon probability distribution, right? So you see that it's not like one is one and everything else is zero. Unless you are at zero temperature. But for every finite temperature, this quantity scales with the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space, or in other words, with the number of particles. So as you well know from thermodynamics, thermodynamic entropy is additive, right? It goes like the volume. This is all I'm saying, it goes like the volume. So it's called the volume law. So you have a lot of entropy, but if you do unitary evolution, you start from a pure state, you end up in a pure state, the entropy is always zero, so you cannot increase the entropy. And in fact, you have a similar problem in classical statistical mechanics. Who of you knows or remembers what similar problem this is? That in some sense, even classically, your evolution, your Hamiltonian evolution, cannot increase the entropy. Why cannot increase the entropy?
Reversibility?
That's a very good point that we expect if things are reversible, so let's pretend we don't know the second principle of thermodynamics, right? Because we are really looking at everything from the microscopic point of view. So we don't know, in principle, that entropy is irreversible. Maybe entropy is reversible. Let's pretend that we don't know that, okay? So from the microscopic point of view, which is right now the point of view that we are adopting, because we are looking at the evolution, maybe entropy is reversible. So it could increase in some evolutions and decrease in other evolutions. Which is somehow the point of Hamiltonian evolution. But I'm saying something stronger. It's not just that it can be reversible. It is that it cannot change at all under Hamiltonian evolution. The reason being Liouville theorem, right? The probability of being in a state, so probability is measure theory. The volume in the phase space is the volume of your initial state, of your initial conditions. And under Hamiltonian evolution, this volume cannot increase. It's measure preserving. And just like unitary evolution is norm preserving, in particular, it's preserving these probabilities. So entropy cannot increase. But second principle of thermodynamics or thermalization or things go here, oh, now this is worse than equilibration. Because you see, in equilibration, my typical value of A is the trace of A in phi bar. In other words, is the sum of the n eigenvalue is the average of my possible outcomes weighed by the initial distribution of probability. Do you agree that this is an identity? So this equilibrate, we are saying when we equilibrate means we are almost always very close to this number. As you can see, here there is nothing irreversible. In fact, we did it with a unitary evolution because I have a perfect memory of my initial conditions. This number knows where we are coming from. And if there is any kind of equilibration, must have this form. And now I'm asking, oh, it must have this form because it's unitary evolution, we cannot forget. However, it must also be like this, like the expectation value in this state. But this state is forgetful. We don't know the initial conditions anymore. In fact, we retain information about only one quantity, which is what? We have only one parameter. We only remember the expectation value of the energy of our initial condition. But if you have two initial conditions that have two very different expectation values of the energy, they cannot thermalize to the same Gibbs state, right? Because energy is conserved, even during thermalization. But they will thermalize to two Gibbs states at different temperature. But if I have an infinite number of different initial conditions all within the same energy shell, they will all thermalize to exactly the same probability distribution that has only parameter beta, the temperature. So I forget the initial state. But I'm saying, oh, but I remember the initial state. So how is this possible? Yeah?
The A and N could all be roughly constant at the initial thermal.
Okay, so this is one possibility that your operator does not see much difference between different eigenstates. And also, as I change N, changes very slowly with N. So if my initial state is peaked around some energy, then in that case, this would be more or less like this goes to one, just a one of them. Well, this is ETH. This is an eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. It's just requiring by hand that A does not see the initial conditions. So ETH, it is hard and interesting to see whether a given Hamiltonian obeys ETH, but the hypothesis in itself is just requiring ad hoc that your state, your operator does not see the eigenstates. So you have no time evolution because you don't see that you're in different eigenstates. And in each eigenstate already obeys the Gibbs distribution. So it is kind of a cheap request. I mean, you just ask for that. Now, what is not cheap is to check that for a given Hamiltonian, this is true. That's very hard. So, but now I want to find some generic mechanism, okay, for thermalization. I don't want just to say, oh, if my Hamiltonian is such that I don't know that there is time evolution, and by magic, the expectation value of A in an eigenstate is already the thermal average. I don't know how, but it is, I require it. So if I want a mechanism, I have to do something more. So we are back to the square one of saying, how is it possible that something that is non-forgetful becomes forgetful? And now you see this, that when I compute an expectation value, so my expectation value of A is the trace, sorry for the triviality, of A in whatever state I'm doing. But this is also equal to the expectation value of A onto phi restricted to the support of A. And in fact, this is the expression that defines what I mean by the reduced density matrix. You can prove that phi A defined in this way is exactly what you need for this to be an identity. Okay, so now you see suddenly reduced density matrices have appeared. And now quantum mechanics comes to rescue because although it is true that phi A is pure, then phi T is pure, maybe phi can be pure and phi A can be not pure. Right? Because phi is entangled. This is the meaning of entanglement. A state is entangled if a pure state is entangled, if and only if its restriction is not pure. This is exactly the definition. Okay, now let's play with this. So let's say, because now we want to go back, we want to understand time evolution. Let's say that I have my initial condition, phi, that is pure. It's not only pure, it's also non-entangled, right? So it is phi A tensor phi B. So now if I look at phi A, is pure or not?
Yes.
Yes, pure. Okay, so this means that our system, even locally, is away from equilibrium. This is a pure state, so this is not like the thermal average. We are starting away from equilibrium. Now we evolve in time, so we have our phi t equal ut phi. And we know that this is pure, right? Unitary evolution is not changing that. But what we are interested in is phi A at the time t. And this is equal to the trace over B of ut phi. Now, this is pure. What happens when I trace over B? We don't know. But in general, this map is not a unitary map. In fact, it may happen that this is not pure. If this happens, we say that the map UT is not only unitary, but it's also entangling. Right? So this is what's happening, that we start with a non-entangled state, but then my unitary evolution is preserving the purity of the full state, but is entangling it. which means that when we later look at it locally, oh, now it's not pure. And if it is very not pure, so if its purity has volume law, then it may happen that it looks like a thermal state. So this is the logic that we have. And question is, how likely this is? Is it something special? Definitely it can happen, but is it something special, is it something fine-tuned or not? So how do we attack this problem? We attack it in two steps. The first step is, let's pretend that my Hamiltonian is ergodic. By ergodic, I mean that starting from any initial condition, there is always a time t such that this state has arbitrarily components on every other state in the Hilbert space. Okay, so I can explore the whole Hilbert space through this unitary evolution. Okay, so if this is true, phi of t at large enough t is like picking a random state in the Hilbert space. The only thing that can prevent you from being ergodic is if the Hamiltonian, there are some regions that cannot explore, like when you have ergodicity breaking. You remember when we looked at symmetry breaking? But this can only happen if you have some symmetries. Or in other words, thinking of Noether's theorem means you have conserved quantities. If you have conserved quantities, you cannot explore those states that have a different value for those quantities. But if there are no conserved quantities, which means there are no symmetries, which is the typical case, then you can go anywhere you want. Now, this is an argument that can be made very rigorous. But it's very solid in the form that I told you. You should trust this type of arguments. But it can be made very rigorous. I just can't do it right now. It's too long. So let's say that now my phi of t after Hamiltonian evolution is like a random state. Okay. So now my problem has become this. If phi is random, what is the entropy of phi restricted to A? Does it have volume law? Well, you should correct me on something. There is, even if H is ergodic, there is one conserved quantity, right? I said it before, it's energy. So this cannot be completely random, must be random within an energy shell, within those states that have that energy. But apart from that. And in fact, so my question is, how much is this entropy? And how much should it be in order to have the Gibbs state? So now you remember that the Gibbs state from ordinary statistical mechanics is the state that maximizes the entropy given the expectation value of the energy. It's exactly that one. So only if my random state is maximally entangled, given the constraints that we have, then we have the thermalization. So my question is, what is the likelihood that a random state in the Hilbert space is maximally entangled? So let's look, for instance, at the state of two spins 1/2. This state, okay, let me write. Is this normalized? Correct me if it's not normalized. Anyway, is this state entangled? Yes or no? No. Is this state entangled? No. This state is maximally entangled, right? It's one of the Bell states. And this one, 1, 0, 1, 1. No, sorry, 1, 0, 0, 1. Is entangled, but not maximally entangled. And if I put some other coefficients here that are properly normalized, is entangled, but not maximally entangled, unless alpha equal beta equal 1 over square root of 2. And there are infinite ways of choosing alpha and beta, and only one very fine-tuned one is maximally entangled. So for two qubits, for two spins, how likely it is to pick a maximally entangled state in the Hilbert space of two spins? It's very unlikely. What will your intuition tell you about what happens when my Hilbert space starts to grow? Can the situation improve or only get worse? It looks like it's going to get worse, right?
It's like you generate randoms at numbers at random, but subject to a normalization constraint, you get a Gaussian distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they will get closer and closer to the central value. There's a lot of them. So I think it's more likely.
So you're summoning something very important that we're going to use. You're right. Whatever will happen on average, this is what you're saying, whatever will happen on average will be also very typical. Okay, so we need to understand this average. And your intuition is very right. Because we are in a very big Hilbert space, and it's like averaging over all these phases, the average will also be very typical. In other words, the variance will be very, very, very narrow. Okay, so this is our what we want to compute. And, okay. So, I don't want to anticipate the answer. So what's the answer? We'll see tomorrow. So let's just comment on what is that we need to do. What average is this? It's not the time average. Is not the average when we do this. Because here, this is like an average, but we have one state. And we compute the average value of A in one state. This is not the temporal average. I am averaging over all the phis. This is a type of average that you have, I think, never seen. I pick a state in H. I compute its entropy to a subregion A. Then I pick another one. I compute it again. And then of all these values, I take the average. So you see, I have to average over ensembles of states in the Hilbert space. So I have to give some probability distribution over the states in the Hilbert space. And of course, things like this, if I have a Hamiltonian, I could measure what's their energy, measure their expectation value, and I give a probability distribution. But that is not what we are asking, right? Because the ergodic theorem is not saying, oh, we can only explore states at low energy. Ergodic means ergodic. I go anywhere. In other words, it's like saying, is the Boltzmann distribution with the zero beta at infinite temperature? I can see anything I want, a completely random state. So I want a measure on H that is the same no matter what state you have. So it must be invariant under unitary transformations, because this is my Hilbert space. This is my state phi, which will have some probability of being picked. But then, so here I have a region that has a certain measure. But I'm saying, well, this other region must have exactly the same measure if it's obtained by unitarily transforming every state in here and here. So that's why the measure on the Hilbert space that we're going to use is whatever measure is unitarily invariant, and there is only one, which is called the Haar measure. So from tomorrow, we'll define what is the Haar measure, how to take averages in the Hilbert space, which means we are looking for what are the average features of states in the Hilbert space. What is the average feature that has any state in the Hilbert space? What is its average expectation value for some observable? What is its average entanglement? What is its average? If I just pick a state in the Hilbert space, what happens on average and what happens typically? Your colleague has a very strong intuition that whatever is average is also typical. We will see that under some certain conditions, this is true. This is what we set out to do from tomorrow. Okay. Yeah?
How typical is it that some observable will only have finite support in the Hilbert space?
Oh, this is a great question. And of course, this depends on how you model it, right? Because right now, I am modeling my Hilbert space saying all the states should be equally likely. There is no reason why I should have a state in front of me in the Hilbert space more than another one. Okay, so this is a model. And this can be subject to critique, right? One can say, wait a second, why? I don't know. But right now it seems reasonable. Let's talk now about observables. So now you're asking a question about observables. How typical it is to have observables that are only local in the Hilbert space? Well, according to what we have said so far, you only have those. We do not think that those that have infinite support are even possible, not just atypical. We think they are not possible. Nobody has ever seen a five-body interaction. Of course, you can engineer that, but it becomes harder and harder and harder, exponentially harder, to engineer a K-body interaction becomes exponentially hard in K. By exponentially hard means that the fidelity that you have for the desired outcome goes exponentially 1 over e to the k. So it's hard. And we don't know why. So we just know that this is what we see in nature. And now this is a question that we can discuss later, if we should try to answer this question or not. I would love to have this discussion, but when it's not recorded.